had resisted considerable influence to bring his shares to the public. There were two small brokers, one who Pring and one Kitchen Tabraham, and they, one of their partners in each firm, knew him personally, and they had never made any effort to suggest that he should use them if he was coming to the market or making any approach like that. One of them was on a holiday, I think, with him on a boat and so on, and he appreciated this very much. When the time came, he put the business to them. They were not geared up really for such an issue, and fortunately we had the office manager then was absolutely first class fellow called Mick Pagram, who knew more or less everything there was to know about new issues, management, such, and with Harry Bishop it's set up to arrange how this should be done, and we certainly got the lion's share of that. It was quite a dramatic day. We had the call of shares from Lord Nuffield's that to prevent the shares going so high. He wanted to keep the price within bounds so that people could take shares in his company at a reasonable price rather than him making a lot more money. And I suppose the queue around the we had half the pillar we stood by was occupied with the dealers standing on the benches, and I suppose there must have been six or seven deep perhaps pressing forward to be able to deal. There was one chap who got hold of the iron, the brass rail, which was above the seat with his arms, and then with his legs trailing over part of the queue, he worked his way through his strength of his arms, buying shares from each of the dealers, and then jumped off at the other end, having probably completed his business. So it's one of the things I remember seeing.
What were you doing this day?
Today we were running the ordinary motor book and two of the engineering books as well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that virtually the whole of the stock exchange interest was on that deal. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true that there were people who were able to buy shares from us mm-hmm. and nip across the floor to one of the other jobbers in it and sell them at a profit. So there was a continuing market.
Mm-hmm. Were there any complaints that the business had been done in this particular way?
How formal the complaints were, I don't know. There was certainly a lot of jealousy and criticism perhaps was raised, but after all, they were his shares and he was entitled to dispose of them as he wished in those days. There were not the regulations for better or for worse, which makes the handling of businesses a great deal more expensive. And I don't think the complaints ever really got far because no recognised rules had been breached. And indeed, it could be said that the shares were being available to the public at a lower, well, certainly to their brokers, mm. and therefore to the public at a lower price than would have done if it had been issued in another way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was ever really seriously taken up.
Did this episode feature as an important episode in the development of Biscuit Bishop?
Yes, I would say it did. It got possibly not in the papers as such, but certainly in the stock exchange. We did get a lot of kudos for it because the settlement went very well. We'd made a good chunk of money out of it, And I think it was agreed that we, that on the dealing side, on the floor of the house, that Harry Bishop had organised it very well, and that Vic Pegram and the office had organised the settlement very well. So I think it gave us a definite markup that we could handle such deals. Mm.
The newspapers which report the episode at the time don't actually refer to any of the jobbers concerned. Can you think of why that might be the case?
I didn't realise that until you'd mentioned it, but I think it was, in those days, it was always, well, certainly as regards the rules of the Stock Exchange, no advertising was allowed, and I think that the papers also accepted that, that they were very chary about mentioning firms that had done something by the well, or possibly even that they had done it madly, because that was rather breaching the etiquette, and if not directly, the rules of the Stock Exchange, of course, wouldn't have applied to them. But the etiquette, I think, was still fairly strong.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've already described Bisgood Bishop as being a fairly typical firm during the 1930s. How would you describe the jobbing system generally at that time?
I think I tend to defend the jobbing system, not only because I was in it. It was very adaptable, and I think that nearly all the times through its history, it succeeded in adapting itself to what was wanted. For instance, those days there were much more private client business, and which was very suitable. The capital in those days was smaller, the turnover was smaller, the institutions were starting to build up, mm-hmm. and when they were taking over from the private clients, as the years passed, so the jobbing firms became larger, either through spreading themselves or the big mergers. And when the big mergers came, the one that obviously leaps to mind is Webb Durlacher, that was a very significant development, because it linked the large gilt jobber with a large industrial jobber, so it was beginning to cover the spectrum. So it was always adapting itself, and that's why I think that I wouldn't like to criticise the operators in the Big Bang, because it was something so out of the ordinary, but I think one of the snags was that it was imposed rather than developing at its own speed, and I think that's why it hit many snags. The jobbing system, I think, was open to criticism, but there certainly wasn't, I don't think, a better one. You could have the open outcry system, but again, it very often destroyed a market more than making it. The jobbing system in those days was based, is quite a good rule, that the only people who were entitled to know the price and size of a deal had been done was the client, the broker, and the jobber. So that it was much more difficult to spoil a market if it becomes known that somebody's bought 500,000 shares and has only sold 250,000, the obvious tendency of everybody is, was 250,000 unsold shares, to knock the price away. Jobbers even went to the lengths of not checking bargains in the checking rooms, I mentioned previously, where you might be near another jobber or another broker might overhear, but would check by letter. Just send the letter around to the office manager so that it didn't appear in the checking room at all. And I think that a lot of business was done like that quite reasonably in those days. Times have changed, and obviously the market's changed with it, but in those days it was acceptable and it worked, that's best we can say.
Were there any big firms during the 1930s that dominated their markets?
There were big firms certainly dominating the markets. in gilts and in industrials, nor smaller firms which had a niche in more specialised markets, where one that I would mention, I'm sure you wouldn't mind, was Jenkins, which was a smallish firm, but they who dealt in entertainment shares. And they had a very strong niche in that, because the head partner knew a lot of the directors or chairmen of the companies in which he dealt, and was quite able to hold his own with one of the bigger firms competing against him. There were Merton and Adams, I think I'm right in saying, the paper market. Although they were not a large firm, they were very strong in that. But as the time came, of course, the smaller firms began to perhaps realize from the beginning of the future that it was better to go with a larger firm, bring their books and their people with them under some terms, and that spread obviously considerably. I think, I give you a very rough idea that in, say, 1965-6, there were approximately 60 jobbing firms, which I would have said perhaps sort of 10 big, 14 medium, and the smaller firms, I say, they might have been the old almost two partnership jobbers, and others who had a definite scale of the market. Then down, I suppose, one comes to 74-5, which was when, which is the year I quit, because that's the time we became a company. There were 24 jobbers, and that included 6 country jobbers, which in the old days were separate. They weren't in the stock exchange, which was the London Stock Exchange in those days. So it's a fairly dramatic drop over, that's only about 10 years, isn't it?
Going back to the 30s, which was politically a very unsettled period, did the political climate impinge on the stock exchange in your recollection?
Yes, very much. I think one of the factors which had a very large effect on the market was certainly the rise of Hitler in Germany. Everything would be going quite smoothly, and then suddenly he would announce that once more his patience was exhausted and he was going to gobble somebody up. One was never quite sure at what stage of the proceedings governments were going to take any action other than protesting and using the League of Nations, which was completely useless. So that there was a lot of disquiet as to what might happen. Then became peace, but it became not a situation where war wasn't going to break out. Then it resumed again, but it was certainly an undercurrent of this. One of the particular factors that I remember, because we were involved in it, was the start of the rearmament. Now, a lot of this were motor car companies, funnily enough, were involved in this because I suppose at that time they had spare capacity, and they were making various bits and pieces for the Air Force rearmament, which certainly gave them quite a fillip. Of course, unfortunately, so many of the motor car companies, that motorbike companies we used to deal in, disappeared. Some were taken over, but others falling by the wayside. One I remember when I was a blue button, I asked my boss why a Riley company which produced a jolly good car. They were pound shares standing at 65 bob, paying 20% dividend. They looked very cheap. And he said, well, that's for the barge pole. When I was a dealer, it was within 2 years, they had gone bankrupt, and I was making quite a good profit dealing them on the basis of a farthing to a halfpenny. So there were a lot of sad things with the companies disappearing like that.
Do you remember the effects of an actual crisis on the stock exchange? For example,
yes,
the Czechoslovakian crisis.
In those days, I think the basic fact was that jobbers didn't have to deal with one another. The system, if you wanted to deal with another jobber, you challenged him. And then it was up to him whether he dealt with you or not. Therefore, if there was a big crisis, all the jobbers would be sellers. Therefore, there was no point in going to knock the price down by going to another jobber, because really make it further. So you would then make a price in a smaller amount than you would normally quote, a bit wider and a bit lower. And then there would be brokers who would have either orders of in a company which they had been buying, and you would approach them and say, now the price is, whatever it might be, 34.65 shillings, keeping that a sort of few hundred shares. But I reckon that if you could get a buying order somewhere about 33.6, you might be able to do some business. So they come back and say, well, you're a bit optimistic, aren't you? But we'll give you 33 bob for 10,000. So you'd immediately have a buyer. Your own position, you might be a bull, you might want to cut it, you might even want to say, right, I want to get rid of my position and deal. But then you be able to make a price, we say 33.9 and 2,500. If the chap wanted to sell them at 3.3, you'd buy your 2.5 and then stuff the buyer at 3 bob, cutting a loss on that, and make, we say 2.6, 3 bob until you got his new price. So you had a more orderly retreat. You didn't have this flashing of red all over the screen and an emotional upset. And people said, right, let's face it, if there's going to be a real war, then everything's out of the window. If there isn't, and it's going to be settled as it usually is, these are attractive, and it's not affected their business in the slightest, and they're 2 shillings cheaper than they were last week. That, I think, was, and as I said, was one of the ways that it did work quite well, and one knew the brokers that would be interested, or they might even come in and say, well, if they're flat, I'll give such and such a price.
Would a crisis depress turnover? Would people want to sell, or would they simply hang on and wait and see?
A real crisis would probably increase turnover. Once you've got a basis which people are prepared to deal, then it might get quite active, particularly if it was a leading stock, where there was going to be a price. I mean, the old days, I suppose, if ICI moved tuppence or threepence, it was a world-shattering event, so that you could then get a good turnover gain on a new base. But I think that it would have stopped perhaps the investment side, to the degree that people wouldn't have been rather worried about recommending shares if now they're going to drop over to the next day.
Well, I'd now like to leap forward in time. In the earlier interview that we recorded, you talked about your career following the war and the development of Biscuit Bishop and the jobbing system generally. What I'd like now is to ask you some more specific questions about aspects of the jobbing system. Towards the end, as we come up to the 1970s and Big Bang, and also some of your other contributions to the work of the stock exchange. The Wilson Committee in the late 70s spoke about the problems that jobbing firms were encountering and described some of the ways in which they were dealing with these problems. One of the ways it referred to was the operation of joint books by particular firms. Can you describe what a joint book was and whether Bisgood was involved in running joint books with other firms?
Yes, a joint book system arose normally when there were two jobbers in the stock, which had become very unmarketable. And rather than keep an inferior market going, the two jobbers would get together and form a joint book. This had to be obtain the council's agreement. Could only be for a time. In other words, it couldn't be a permanent arrangement. Sometimes it would be for a particular situation. Other times it would be just that the market was so bad that without that joint book, neither job was going to make much effort to make a market in the stock. The joint book then operated that you would decide on what price you were both going to make. This was always one of the slightly amusing things, is when the joint book failed to keep in touch with one another and they were still quoting a different price. I always felt that the broker was perfectly, provided he didn't know, in other words, he'd only gone to one of them and dealt, that was the fault of the jobbers. We might even touch on that later. But if he obviously checked with both and knew that they were a joint book and knew there was a difference, then he should have put them right. This consisted that any bargain done was split between the two of them. So that if A bought 5,000 shares, he booked the bargain 5,000 from the broker, she was then responsible for, and he sold at the same price he bought them, 2,500, to jobber B. It worked, on the whole, quite well. I don't think, I think the council were right that they didn't particularly like it, but as I say, they accepted it as being at least a method of keeping market going in that stock. And on the whole, it worked quite well. We certainly had a few, but I don't think it was ever a very large number of shares large number of companies that were involved in this. And as I say, you also then, when you split it, when things got back to normal, then they went their own way, they settled up the existing position between them and then resumed normal. Mm-hmm. But it did work quite well, and I think it did prevent the unnecessary cutthroat business which could go on in a difficult stock. After all, whether one likes it or not, as a job you can say, well, we provide a service and we hope to make money out of it. Mm-hmm. But I think one's got to be honest that you tend to make money out of it by providing the service. And therefore, if you weren't making any money in the stock, was it worth going on dealing? Mm-hmm. If the two jobbers said, well, this is hopeless, we're not going to make any more, well, then the public and the company itself and so on would be far worse off than having a joint book. That is its justification. It was not justified whether it was a proper market gain, and then the council could, if they saw the number of marks coming up, say, well, there is a market, so you better stop it.
Did it help demand for the stock in any way? Did it make it more marketable? Or was its prime function to hold the price up?
The prime function was so that the brokers could deal in more reasonable size. Because if you knew what the other chap was doing and you were working it together, you weren't going to try and knock him out and he wasn't going to try and knock you out. So it made a much more stable market.
What were the characteristics of an unmarketable stock?
I thought the main thing that was unmarketable would be if there was one particular operator buyer or seller, and no other interest in it. So that you had a seller, or sellers in the plural, with no interest in it, no buyers. You could make a sort of small price, try and keep something going. You could make a nominal, you could make a basis. Those are other ways which a jobber would, not actually making a dealing price, but he could indicate a basis, or he could say it's a nominal, and then say, well, I've got a buyer, I've got a seller, and so on. I think that was really the thing. Also, Hawke Siddeley were, until they split, were always a very difficult market, although there's quite a lot of interest in it. It was a high price share and very volatile and swung violently, as did Rolls-Royce in the old days. But I wouldn't say they're marketable, because it was a market and you could deal, but it was a difficult market. The unmarketable ones are where you've, I mean, literally, you haven't got a buyer or a seller, you haven't got a faint idea what the right price is, so you've got to make one in your head. In the old days, when board of directors or families had an interest in a share, I was very helpful, and maybe insider trading or not, but you could go to the purchase company's secretary or the chairman or director if you knew him, or the broker if you didn't know him, and say, look, I've got a seller of these shares. Would you see whether anybody on the board's interested in making a bid? And they would, normally in those days, it would make a bid, and then after time, the price would go better, and you'd suddenly remember, yes, I sold them those shares, so you go and say, well, look, you know, you got a profit on these now, would you like to sell them? So that did help, and there were companies who, chairman or people on the board, did try and keep it going, and they would buy it on a very flat day, like we were saying, one of the crisis days in when Hitler was on the move, and then when everything was love and cooing again, and the price went back, they'd turn them out. They'd suit everybody. They made a profit, jobber made a profit, and the buyers and the sellers could deal.
When did the shops stop operating?
Well, the shop, I suppose, didn't really stop operating until markets became much, much larger, so it was much more recently. And I think, I would say that it's not an easy question to answer directly, but I would say that the shop stopped when the outside holders were so much, and operators were so much larger than the actual shop itself, which might only be perhaps the chairman and his wife or something like that. But they would have an interest, and it was always worth approaching the shop.
Were they ever open to abuse?
It was open to abuse, but do you mean if they were being approached? I could never see there could be any abuse. They might buy the shares because they thought they were dirt cheap. They might sell them because they thought they were far too high and they're going to cut the dividend. But if the approach had been made to them to do it, it seemed to be perfectly okay. It was only as, which happened from time to time, I'm thinking of sellers mostly. There was one company where we were very unmarketable and we bought some stock, and the next day they sort of passed the dividend and made a loss and so on and so forth. And we followed it up and found that the seller had been quite an attractive secretary of one of the directors. So I don't know whether that's where pillow talk comes from, but we didn't do anything about it yet. But it was just, in those days, it was much easier to follow because, of course, names were passing through the offices.
So if there was any abuse, it came from the directors taking advantage of the fact that they had...
That they had the inside information and acted on it rather than that they were approached and said, right, shares too low or the shares too high, we'll deal.
One other aspect of the jobbing system that the Wilson Committee referred to were minimum spread agreements between jobbers. I'll ask you the same question. Did Biscuit Bishop have any experience of these?
Yes, yes. This was a... I think we'll start at the beginning. Costs had increased very considerably, both in salaries, rents, and so on and so forth. And whereas perhaps in the old days a penny price was quite reasonable, the profit made on dealing on a penny price was okay, enabled firms to operate at a profit. It was becoming unprofitable when all your costs had gone up. If there was a very large turnover, it didn't matter very much. If there wasn't all that turnover, then, and we had perhaps four jobbers competing in one stock, each trying to cut the price to get what business there was, it became unprofitable. So they decided that, just trying to think whether we actually I think the council were in fault, but they neither gave it their blessing nor said you can't do it, unless if it became a scandal. So you would say, right, it's a fourpenny price. Everybody quotes a fourpenny price, but of course you've got to realise that one chap might be quoting